Right now I shall take this offer of a truce in the room down the passage and present it to the very important men," his voice went flat to say those words, "who are discussing what to do about Borogravia. You'll get a truce, the food, and probably some other help."
"How do you know that?" said Polly. "They haven't discussed it."
"Not yet. But, as I told you, I used to be a sergeant. Angua." The door opened. Angua came in. As Vimes had said, you couldn't tell who was a werewolf until you found out. "And now I'd better have a shave before I go to see the very important men," said Vimes. "People set a lot of store by shaving."
Polly felt embarrassed walking down the steps with Sergeant Angua. "How did you start a conversation? So, you're a werewolf, then?"
would be sort of idiotic. She was glad that Jade and Maledicta had been left in the waiting room.
"Yes, I am," said Angua. "But I didn't say it," Polly burst out. "No, but I'm used to situations like this. I've learned to recognise the way people don't say things. Don't worry.
You followed us," said Polly.
"Yes.
So you must have known we weren't men."
"Oh, yes," said Angua. "My sense of smell is much better than my eyesight, and I've got sharp eyes. Humans are smelly creatures. For what it's worth, though, I wouldn't have told Mr. Vimes if I hadn't heard you talking to one another. Anyone could have heard you. You don't need to be a werewolf for that. Everyone's got secrets they don't want known. Werewolves are a bit like vampires in that way. We're tolerated if we're careful."
"That I can understand," said Polly.
"So are we," she thought.
Angua stopped by a heavy, studded door. "He's in here," she said, producing a key and turning it in the lock. "I'll go back and chat with the others. Come and find me when you're ready." Polly stepped inside, heart pounding, and there was Paul. And there was a buzzard on a perch by the open window. And on the wall, where Paul was working so intensely that his tongue was sticking out of the corner of his mouth and he hadn't even noticed the door opening, was another buzzard, flying in the heart of the sunrise. Right now, Polly could forgive Ankh-Morpork anything. Someone had found Paul a box of coloured chalks. What was a long day began to get longer. She had a kind of power. They all did. People gave them space, watched them. The fighting had stopped, and they were the cause, and no one knew exactly why. There were lighter moments. They might have power, but General Frock gave the orders. And General Frock might give the orders, but it was permissible to suppose that it was Sergeant Major Jackram who anticipated them. And perhaps that was why Shufti asked Polly and Tonka to go with her, and they were ushered into a room where a couple of guards stood on either side of a sheepish young man called Johnny, who had fair hair and blue eyes and a gold earring and his pants around his knees in case Shufti wanted to check his other distinguishing feature. He also had a black eye.
"Is this the one?" said Major Clogston, who was leaning against the wall eating an apple. "The General has asked me to tell you that there will be a dowry of 500 crowns with the army's compliments."
Johnny brightened up slightly when he heard that.
Shufti gave him a long and careful look.
"No," she said at last, turning away. "That's not him."
Johnny opened his mouth, and Polly snapped,
"No one asked you to speak private."
And such was the nature of the day that he shut up.
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid he's the only candidate," said Clogston. "We've got any amount of earrings, heads of fair hair, blue eyes, Johnnies, and, surprisingly, a fair number of carbuncles. But he's the only one with everything. Are you sure?"
"Positive,"
said Shufti, still staring at the boy.
"My Johnny must have been killed."
Clogston walked over and lowered her voice.
"In that case, sir, the General did say, informally, that a marriage certificate, a ring, and a widow's pension could be arranged," she said.
"Can she do that?" whispered Polly.
"For one of you, today, you'll be amazed at what can be done," said Clogston. "Don't think too badly of her. She means well. She's a very practical man."
"No," said Shufti. "It's... well, no. Thank you, but no."
"Are you sure?" said Polly.
"Positive,"
said Shufti, looking defiant. Since she was not naturally a defying kind of person, it was not quite the look that she thought it was and ought to have been, having overtones of hemorrhoid sufferer. But the effort was there. Clogston stepped back.
"Well, if you're certain, Private, fair enough then. Take that man away, Sergeant."
"Just a moment," said Shufti.
She walked over to the bewildered Johnny, stood in front of him, held out her hand and said, "Before they take you away again, I want my sixpence back, you son of a bitch." Polly held out her hand to Clogston, who shook it and smiled. There had been another little victory of sorts. If the landslide is big enough, even square pebbles will roll. Polly headed back to the rather larger cell that had been made available as the women's barracks, or at least the barracks for the official women. Men, grown men, had fallen over themselves to put cushions in there and bring in wood for the fire. It was all very strange. Polly felt they were being treated as something dangerous and fragile, like, say, a huge and wonderful jar full of poison.